Hey there, folks. Welcome back to the Classic Camera Revival. And we haven't done one of these episodes in a while. I believe it was the start of season two that we talked about lenses the last time. Yeah. So we figured that as much as we like the cameras we mount these lenses onto, sometimes it's the lenses that really make the difference. Honestly, a good lens on a bad camera can really make all the difference. So we are going to be talking about some of our favorite lenses and one lens that every single person around the table loves. So let's get rolling.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
So there is one lens that is in the Nikon catalog that has been around since they launched the Nikon F. And that is the classic, the one, the only, the one with the weirdest maximum aperture that I've ever heard of. And that is the Nikkor 105 f2.5, which has only seen one change in its entire history since it was first introduced. This is the lens that, of course, has captured the iconic Afghan girl, and the camera that captured it we'll be talking about later, but right now we are going to be talking about the lens, and as I mentioned, every single person around the table has a version of this lens, loves this lens, and it's just almost, I would reckon to say, the perfect short telephoto lens, and that, of course, is the Nikkor 105mm f2.5. So, John, I believe you have the AI version of it.
I'm actually on my second version of my second copy of the lens, because my first, which was a pre-AI, was stolen along with my previous Nikon F4 a couple of years back.
Right.
But I replaced the F4, though it's not as nice as Bill's, but I'm not bitter. And I got another 105, and mine is actually, or the second copy, is actually a pre-AI lens that has been converted for AI. It's not a factory conversion. The conversion is so-so, like the secondary aperture scale is a bit slapdash, but they got the they did the modification on the back ring. And I guess that's a danger of AI conversion, since Nikon stopped doing them years ago. It was something that looked easy enough to do that people who probably had no business trying to do it did it, and there are a lot of hack jobs out there. So if you're looking for one, I'd be very careful. But no, it's a great lens. It's one of my favorites. Like for portraiture, it is the absolute perfect length. And actually, I was out shooting with it yesterday on the Nikon F that I just got back from Quebec, and it's just a match made in heaven.
Fantastic. Bill.
Oh boy. The 105 2.5, Nikon's Jesus lens. It can do almost everything except sign complicated insurance forms, but its real forte is making people look good. And it's also, I've used it even in landscape work, where if I need to pull something in much closer. Now, I have all three examples, the pre-AI, the AI, and then the AIS, which I brought with me today for recording. But again, Alex brought his too, so I think his one got the beauty shot. Either way, a classic lens. I think the lens formula has pretty much remained the same all the way through. I know Nikon had sort of a sonar formula up until about 67, 68, then they switched over to another one.
But yeah.
I can't quite remember the whole story behind that. And of course, you know, I'm Mr. Diligent Internet, you know, researcher, especially with Photography in Malaysia, which is a great camera and lens resource. If you are following our podcast, I have that site to blame for my camera collection today, but that's another story for another time. But yes, the 105 2.5, you know, if you just have to have one version, I would just say the AIS, the advantage of it is it's the most compact. It has a built-in lens hood, which is great. The AI version is a lot like its non-AI predecessor, you need to get an accessory lens hood to go with it, just so it makes your image look greater. And of course, the pre-AI goes without saying. If you've got like an old Nikon F or a Nikkormat, yep, and you're only shooting with pre-AI gear, you can actually save a few bucks by just getting the pre-AI version and you're off to the races.
I'll throw one thing in about the copy that I have. I'm lucky enough to have the metal lens hood that was designed for that lens.
Nice.
Which is nice to have.
And James, you have the probably the oldest version of the lens around the table, because I also have the AIS version that came with my when I got my F3.
This bad boy is actually, yeah, I would say early 70s, pre-S. Oh, it's got the coating.
Ooh,
this
yes.
is like this is so, classic mid-set. It's probably like 72, 73, give yep. or take.
So this is, so as we mentioned, the formula has only changed once. And again, I don't remember exactly what the change in the lens grouping is, but it's in the episode notes. I know that because I've written them already about this particular lens. So yeah, when they added the coating, they updated the lens elements. So, James, take it away.
Yeah, I, you know, not much else to add on this lens. You know, it's got great qualities to it. Mine is, it's, I think it's been AI'd. I think it was originally a pre-AI version. But
well, there are
it's
the,
AI'd.
Yeah, it looks like it's like a homemade AI job. Or possibly Nikon did it, but it's definitely a
the
pre-AI
secondary, version. The secondary scale looks pretty good.
Yeah. But it's got the, like the, you know, where the window where the skylight reads the aperture, it's all white. The aperture readings are all white, which I think indicates pre-AI. But it looks like the ring might have been changed though, because it has the AI notch in there.
Yes,
or the like the tab.
Yeah,
that
is a conversion kit of some kind.
Yeah, definitely been converted. But yeah, this lens is it's actually very compact. It's not too heavy. I enjoy shooting with it. It's not for me personally, my ideal focal length. I like 85 more so than I like 105. But you know what? It's a terrific lens. If you shoot any vintage Nikon bodies, like, this is a must have in your kit. It's it can become a 135 if you take two steps forward. It can become an 85 if you take two steps backwards. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
And you shoot it wide open, you get magic.
Exactly. And that's an interesting aperture, too, at 2.5 wide open. It's odd. Like, it's a little, you know, typically you might think of, 2.8 or something, so you get, like, I guess one third of a stop more. But yeah. I really like the fall off you get with this light and shooting, with this lens when shooting portraits with it. And I haven't, like, I do have a modern 105. 2.8 macro that I like to shoot portraits with as well too, which is touch a touch too sharp sometimes. But interesting. They haven't been able to match anything like it in the current lineup, which is interesting. So,
well, that's an excellent segue. I really can't add anything about the 105 2.5 that hasn't already said. It is one lens that I know will always come with me if I'm out traveling with just a prime lens kit. But on the autofocus side, I too had an 85mm f1.8D. I still kick myself for selling that lens, but I like the 105mm focal length for portraits, for street photography. So on my first trip to New York City, I picked up the autofocus version of it, the 105mm f2D.
Is that a D? That's not a DC, right?
This is a DC.
That's what I thought. It looked
Nikkor.
Like a defocus control lens.
So the one thing, as James mentioned, that makes it unique is that there's the defocus control, where you can essentially adjust the autofocus elements of it. You can adjust it to the front or to the rear.
It's quite an interesting lens. I owned one, actually. I sold it. It's one of those ones that you kind of regret selling it immediately after you've put the money in your bank account. But I did buy something better with it, probably. But
or in my case, putting a battery grip on my D300.
Yeah, there you go. But the lens, it's actually really cool. It has a defocus, a center ring, which is a defocus control ring. You turn it one way, it changes the front, it defocuses the foreground of the image, and you change it the other, turn it the other way,
yeah,
and it does the background component, yeah, of the image. I rarely use the front defocus control.
I usually use the rear as well.
It's usually the rear for me, and I love the lens, optically great, but I used it a lot when I was a wedding shooter, and one of the reasons, yep, why I got rid of it was that the newer lens is just, the autofocus was just so much faster. But if you're doing like still portraits, setup portraits, yeah, formals, I mean,
the
it's really good.
Again, this is a D-type lens, so it doesn't have the built-in autofocus motor like the AFS lenses, so it does rely on the coupler for autofocus. But again, this is my ideal length for street photography. Most of my street photography is done with a Nikon F5 and this particular lens, which, I mean, most people use a rangefinder, you know, low profile.
It's interesting that you have an appreciation for that focal length for street photography. Like, traditionally, I find a lot of street photographers like the 35, so like, you know, just a, yeah, touch wider than normal, yep, or wide normal. So I would say you were definitely unique in that perspective, but I understand that.
I don't want people to know I'm taking,
yeah,
their photo. I want them to be natural in their natural state,
yeah,
talking, doing, but, something, yeah,
it's
else.
It's more of a journalistic or voyeuristic approach to street photography.
Let's go with journalistic. Voyeuristic sounds a bit off.
Well, I mean, night street photography, will you say voyeuristic
in, yes,
the daytime.
Journalistic.
Journalistic.
Yeah.
And it's true, though, like, and I have a more of an appreciation for the 85 millimeter focal length,
mm,
that I prefer for whatever I'm doing, street, yep, photography, landscape, you know, journalistic, whatever, because it's just kind of the way I see things, I guess.
That's right.
And
one of the first model shoots I ever did, I did solely on the 85 1.8D, and those photos are absolutely incredible. And I'm so grateful that I was actually able to photograph the model's wedding. And the one lens that I use the most of on my digital camera is the 105 f2.5. I have an adapter that I can take the F mount to the Sony A6000E mount.
Cool. Yeah, interesting. Well, you know what? It just goes to show you, like, you know, when it comes to lens selection, you know, one of the things that a lot of people forget about is they get so wrapped up in, I must have this gear because it's cool gear, because, you know, I've read it on some blog somewhere that I'm, you know, I must have a 105 or I must have an 85 or I must have a 135. I say forget about all that. It all boils down to how you see the world. Get the focal length.
That's right.
That aligns closest with what you're, how you see framing, how you see,
that's
composition,
right,
how you know what, when you enjoy looking at an image, that something that speaks to you, so you don't have to put the effort in into composition because your equipment is not aligned to the way you see things.
That's right.
Doesn't mean that you don't get other lenses, but if you're going to prioritize it, that's the way I would prioritize it.
Absolutely. Continuing along, John, you have one camera that is one of your favorites, a bit of a pain in the butt to use, I would say, but it has a classic lens on it with a classic name, and before Kodak released the film named Ektar, they had lenses named Ektar.
And actually what I will do, I'm going to talk about this and the Voigtlander lens.
Perfect.
Because they're the same formula.
Yep.
There is an optical formula invented by Voigtlander back in around, I want to say about 1900, 1902, so it's an old formula. It's called the Heliar formula.
Right.
And it's, if let's say a pure like optics workbench, other formulas have surpassed it as time went on, but I am in love with the look of the lenses. Like the 100 millimeter f3.5 Ektar on my Metalist, which again is a pain in the ass camera to use. The Ektar is the only reason I use that camera. If it had a crappy lens, it would be a shelf queen because it's 620 and it's not ergonomically friendly. But that 100 millimeter Ektar makes it so worthwhile because I find the images look cinematic, especially, and what I've been doing more recently with it is trying to use it at more wide open apertures to get separation of foreground and background.
Right.
And it just, it blows me away. I feel like I'm looking at a movie. I'm hoping the Medalist never dies. I'm thinking if the Medalist dies, I'd be tempted to try and go online and find another broken Medalist where the lens is in good condition, find a way to try to remove the lens, and then stick it on something like a baby speed graphic that has a rear focal plane shutter.
That would be fantastic.
And has the bellows to adjust it. It probably wouldn't couple with the rangefinder properly.
No, but that's fine.
But the lens is that good. Now, the other lens that I'm going to talk about is also a Heliar formula. And this lens, it's built by, air quotes, Voigtlander, but in the Cosina days. And this lens came out in 2006. It's the Voigtlander 50mm F2 Heliar Classic, Classic Heliar. I always get it mixed up. This is not a common lens. The one I have has some, you know, Voigtlander anniversary markings on it. And so they're less than 1,000 of the ones that I have made. And it is an absolutely gorgeous lens just because it has, to me, it has a very, very distinctive look. Like words like creamy get thrown around a lot, but to me it looks like very creamy. Just again, maybe not as sharp as, like, it's not going to be as sharp as a Summicron, but it just has character, and I like lenses that have their own individual character.
Well, the world isn't sharp.
Yeah. Who said that sharpness is a bourgeois concept? I think Cartier-Bresson said that.
Yeah, that sounds like something he'd say.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and the 50, like F2, it's not as fast as some other 50 millimeters, but that's not the issue. I can always use my 35 1.7 Ultron.
But I mean, for that. Even the Leica Scimitar was just an F2 lens. Yeah.
So it just to me it shows that an optical formula that is now approaching like 120 years old, not too long from now, is still capable of producing really, really pleasing results. And to me, that's one of the joys of using film cameras, is I find more personality in different film cameras, where there are a lot of digital cameras out there that are technically as close to perfect as you need. But I just look at the results and it's sort of meh.
Sterile.
Hey, that's the word.
The output of a... Well, as yep. I kind of coined it with a friend who's a musician, it's kind of like the session musician who works for... what's her name? Blonde, tall, thin, sells out stadiums.
Oh, that narrows it down.
Taylor Swift?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, the bass player, say the bass player
for
Taylor Swift.
Don't ask me why I knew that right off the top of my head.
You know, the bass player for Taylor Swift.
That's fine.
He or she will hit all the notes bang on every night all the way through the tour, but is like, hasn't got a creative bone in their body. Whereas if you get like, I don't know, the bass player for the Rolling Stones, he may not be perfect, but, you know, that's all part of the organic.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I've got some nifty 50s to talk about.
All right. Let's talk nifty about the nifty 50s.
Nifty 50s. Two of them, actually, because I got two lovely cameras in front of me. I'm going to stay in the Nikon frame of mind here. The 518 AIS. Now, this is like the sort of grandchild of the Nikkor H50F2. And everyone loves the 514, but it's not a perfect lens. There's a slight bit of barrel distortion, and the 50F2, oddly enough, was...
I also don't like about the 1.4 that it only goes down to f/16.
Yeah, and the other thing is, there's a little bit of, just a tiny bit of barrel distortion with the 51.4 I've found, and the 50F2, it was a perfect linear end. If you were to buy one and use, they're cheap as chips, and it's like the same thing with the 50F2 AI. Now, the 518 AIS, it came in two versions. They've got the long nose, which I have on my FM2, which we'll cover in the cameras of the 2000s. And then it also came with sort of a pancake style. I prefer the long nose because, again, I, you know, got big hands. And
yeah. You know. The pancake one is good. The trouble is that the pancake one is often... classed into the Series E,
yes,
Nikkor lenses, but the Japanese version is a metal built, and it just says Nikkor on it.
Interesting. I am not a fan of pancake lenses.
I think
it depends
it's
on the lens.
Yeah,
it's a novelty. Like, again, even Olympus has a pancake 40F2, and people go gaga over it on the used market. But the reality is, it's not that great a lens. But getting back to Nikkor, the 51.8 AIS, I took it with me on a trip up to northern Muskoka a few years back on my FM2 and my F3, and it performed perfectly. Like, it just color rendition, everything is where it's supposed to be. And again, it's cheaper than a 51.4. Now, again, the other camera I brought with me for yet another episode is the Minolta MDX Roker 51.7. Also a descendant of sort of the 55.18, which is from the late 60s, from the SRT days. This one, again, it has the Roker X, which is sort of considered the pinnacle of manual focus Minolta glass. And I was been sort of having an extended shooting with Minolta gear this past summer. And, oh boy, my stuff that I shot in the beaches, the color is just perfect with it. And again, it sort of comes down to the 1.7s are cheaper than the 1.4s, so you wind up saving some bucks. So you lose a little bit on the speed, but not a whole heck of a lot. And you get a very accurate lens.
So I have a Rokor X PF 51.7. So what's the difference between yours that doesn't have the PF and mine that does?
I think it's a difference in the coating. Like, this is like made in the late 70s. Yours is probably made... because the Roker X came around when the XE7 came out.
Okay.
Yours was probably made very early 70s when they left the metal scalloped side, like Nikkor glass from that same era, and then go to the rubber grip.
Okay.
So it was like maybe just like a year or two later, they introduced the Roker X sort of coating, and it was like...
because mine has Roker X, but it also has PF added on to the lens.
I think it was maybe when they had the MC...
okay.
Maybe before they switched it up, before they made it like shutter priority friendly.
Yes, there. It does say MC on it.
Yeah. So if you were to throw that lens on, say, an XD11 or an X700.
It wouldn't work as well?
Well, you can use it in manual. You can use it in aperture priority, but shutter priority, yeah, okay. Not a good idea.
Awesome.
But then who shoots shutter priority anyway? Like,
only people who use Canons.
Yes, well, that's the whole math versus art thing. And
those sports nerds.
Yeah.
Bird photographers.
Canon chose math.
Yep. Okay, and James, last but certainly not least, you have a couple of fantastic Nikon lenses to add to the conversation.
Yeah, so I have a couple here. One, I'm not going to go into too much detail other than just say it's my favorite lens, which is the... Nikon 85 1.4 AFS lens.
Oh, damn.
And, you know, I spent many, many years as a wedding and portrait photographer, so, you know, that's pretty much where you start if you're going to try to make money doing that. What can I say about this lens? It has got some of the nicest, most pleasing optical qualities when you have it wide open for really, really shallow depth of field. A lot of guys like to shoot this at 1.4. I think optimally for this lens, it performs ideally at f2 and 2.8. And you can shoot multiple subjects at 2.8 and still have sharpness corner to corner and have lovely fall off in the background in a very, very shallow depth of field. Terrific lens, extremely well built. I have obviously the professional version, so it's all fully metal barreled. Very, very close in performance to this lens is the 85 1.8. And there's probably about $1,000 price difference, I think, between the two lenses. So, you know what? Unless you're going to be shooting portraits professionally or you're really, really an avid portrait shooter, go with the 1.8.
The 1.8 is fantastic.
Yeah. Just a lovely lens. Were you going to say something, Bill? Or?
Yeah, I've never shot the 85 focal length. So, no? Literally, yeah, no, I'm.
I have an 85 1.8 for my F1N that I should lend you. You'd love it. That's another beautiful Canon lens.
Yeah.
But if you have a digital and you want to try this one, by all means.
Sadly, I have no digital. Yeah.
I've got an 85 1.8 that I got. It's Nikon pre-AI. I got it for under $100.
Oh, yeah.
Because the aperture ring is tight. But to add, and the lens looks sort of KEH ugly, but it works great. And the 85 is a nice sort of, you know, runner up to the 105 we talked about earlier for a portrait.
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of like both the two ends of the spectrum when it comes to, I guess, you know, portrait focal length lenses. And the 80, for me, it's the 85 and the 135. The 105, I see the value in it. It just, you know what? But for me, I see it at both ends, and that's what works for me. But
yep.
That's interesting, because I use 135 in some kits that I have, not in others.
Yeah, like ideally, if I came into some money that I, you know, and I just wanted to kind of gift myself something nice, it would probably be the 135 f/2 DC.
Yes. Yes.
Didn't Zeiss make a 135 recently?
Probably like a Batis or something like that. Like in the new.
No, ones. Actually, they made it manual focus.
Oh,
that's
really?
Chipped. And I think they got an EOS mount, Nikkor, AIS, and I think one other.
I don't know. Ever since I met you guys, I don't buy any new equipment anymore. I just look at old stuff.
Believe me, your bank account will thank you.
I have...
Who needs a car or mortgage?
An AI Nikkor 135 2.8.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic lens.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But I use the 105 more. Now... On the Minolta side, I have a 135.
That's a nice lens.
Which is a fantastic lens, and it's one of the ones that is coming with me to Disney simply for Animal Kingdom for the safari. So I have a little extra reach. I have the adapter that I can mount my Minolta lenses onto my A6000 so that, again, I got that telephoto lens, and I have it on both my digital and my film camera.
That's great. So the other lens that I have here, this one is a bit of a rarity. There was only 12,000 of them made in this version. Now, they did make another version of this lens, but it was purely a manual focus lens. This is a Nikon 200mm f4 macro. This is the D version of the lens. This, if you're a macro shooter, if you like to shoot bugs... Like, this is the lens that you want. This is one of the sharpest lenses that Nikon's ever made. When these things were new, and I believe from 77 to 2005, they were in production. And they only made 12,000 of them, so which is extremely... low production numbers given that amount of time.
And 200 millimeters is weird because I've had a Nikon macro lens and it was 60.
Yeah. So Nikon made, I believe, a 60 and a 105 and a 200. And
Didn't they make a 55 as well?
Possibly made a 55.
Yeah, they made 55s. Like, I've got a 55-35 pre-AI. Lovely piece of glass. I'm borrowing John's 55, I guess, 3.5?
Yeah. But. Sharpest lens Nikon ever made, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I got a regular 200 f4 photo telephoto in AIS mount.
Yeah.
Love to get myself a Q mount.
So they made lots of 200mm focal length lenses, but this micro, which is Nikon's version of macro, they call it micro for some reason.
The Japanese. Yeah,
I think, which is probably more accurate nomenclature than macro. Micro is probably more accurate. Mm. But again, they didn't make too many of them. A lot of people were using this early on for portraits. I don't understand why. Like, there's much faster 200mm lenses to use. But this became a hit with a lot of bug shooters because it's a 200mm focal length. And at 200mm, you're getting a 1-to-1 magnification.
Yep.
So you don't have to invade your bug space. Now, you know, like the 55s, the 60mm macros, and even the 105s. 105, not so much, but the shorter focal length. So, I mean, you have to get in there to shoot really, really close with those short focal length lenses. But with the 200, it's pretty cool. I have the macro flash kit and everything. One of the things, because the flash kit mounts on the front of the lens,
Yep.
It's not the ideal lens for that. I would stick with like a 105.
Even focal a 60 length, would probably
or 60
better.
Would be ideal, but again, it really depends on your subject that you're shooting. So if you're going to disturb the environment by getting so close for a 60, this 200's really, really unique. If anyone's into macro photography, this is the lens you shoot Nikon, of course. This is the lens you probably is on your wish list.
So what do these go for?
These days, they go anywhere from 1,000 on the ugly end to 2,500 on the minty end. Paid.
I had to ask.
I paid 1,600, I think, for this. Actually, it was listed for 1,600, and I managed to bargain stand down to 1,200.
Not bad.
Downtown camera. Oh, nice.
So
that's impressive.
So yeah, I think it was because I was buying an F3 HP with a 58 1.2 on it as well. So I said, "Listen, you're gonna have to give me a deal here, man, or I'm gonna leave, you know, with all my money, and you can keep your cameras." Yep. So anyway,
not bad.
Stan was actually in a good mood that day. Stan's actually been pretty good to me lately. I bought my my Sumilux from him and got a good deal. My titanium one. So
that is a beautiful lens.
I did see one of
stunning
these
lens.
I did see one of these sealed in a box once. There was no price. The person wanted a copy of the Magna Carta.
Yeah, again, because like I don't know why they only made 12,000 of them. It's strange, but
now for lens focal length, we've been sticking pretty close to the telephoto side of things, but John has one more lens to talk about, and it's on the wide, despite being a 50mm.
I'm going to talk about my 50mm f4 Distagon lens, which lives on my Hasselblad. And the 50mm Distagon is the reason I use the Hasselblad, because the Hasselblad, it's sort of like, it's not as bad as the Medalist in terms of ergonomics, but it has some picadillos, shall we say.
It's a Saab 900.
You got it. But the 50mm Distagon is one of my two favorite wide-angle lenses, the other being the 20mm f2.8 Nikkor and the Nikon line. And there is just something about the look of that lens, the fact that normally on a wide-angle lens, you're used to seeing it like in rectangular, like a 3-to-2 ratio, like 6x9 or 35mm format. But in a square format, like the Hasselblad has, it's sort of equivalent, I believe, and I'm doing this from memory, not a good idea. It's not equivalent to the same 35mm wide angle in both dimensions. And I think it's like 28 vertically, closer to 24 horizontally, so it has a really unique look.
It's a nice blend of the two.
Oh, yeah. And it is sharp as blankety-blankety-blank. It also focuses pretty close. So it's just an amazing lens. Now, the thing is, there are a number of versions of it. There's the original C version, which would be in chrome.
And that's the one that I have, and it's a fabulous lens. I need to really get my whole Hasselblad kit out to get CLA'd.
It's worth using. And then there are, you know, various more newer versions, like with the T-Star coating. And then there was one that had like the FLE version, which has that front focus, or the front element adjustability, which is in theory is supposed to give you more sharpness in the corners when shooting up close. And there are Hasselblad snobs. I know it's shocking to think there are Hasselblad snobs, but there are.
Really?
I know. What a shocker. Almost as bad as Leica snobs.
I'm shocked. Like, really? Hassy snobs? I thought Rolleiflex were bad.
And I think I'm just a all-around camera snob then.
It's what's funny is there are people online who say, oh, you have to get the FLE version, that to use anything less is like using a hand melted lump of ice.
No, you don't.
And of course, it's BS. Like the any version of this lens, as long as it's in condition, including like the original ones through modern ones, are absolutely amazing lenses. The only possible thing you might run into is that Some of the models for filters are a bit of a pain to use. You have to go and some of them use like the series type of filters as opposed to modern,
like the Bay 60s.
The Bay ones aren't too bad, but I had one I used to have before I got my newer one. It used a series 7, I want to say, maybe series 8. And it's hard finding series stuff in that bigger size.
Yes. What I do is I use those just the gel filters, and I just hold it up in front of it.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, but I'd say apart from that, you know, I'd say that's not a deal breaker. Any version of this lens, if it's in good condition, check the shutter, is a beauty.
Always check the shutter with Hasselblad lenses.
Well, I have to agree with you, John. Ever since I have a Distagon 50, I have the FLE version.
Of course you do.
Well, I'll tell you.
James has all the nice shiny stuff.
The reason I got the FLE was because I couldn't get over the actual physical length of the T-Star, the other version, the one that you have. It's just so bloody long. And frankly, it was a little bit embarrassing and emasculating, so I opted for the shorter one because I'm comfortable.
Well, the FLE does allow you to compensate.
Yeah, there you go.
And the original one has that sort of flared look. It looks like the end of a blunderbuss.
Yes, it does. It looks like there's a bazooka sticking out the end of your box. Your light tight box, of course, is what I'm referring to.
We won't judge.
But I love it. It's actually, we had our CCR gas meet earlier this month.
And In September.
And I was the only lens. I had that lens on my Hasse the whole time. And I love it. Like it's I don't shoot the 80. I shoot the 50 and I shoot the 150 on my Hasse. Yep. So, I couldn't agree with you more, John. It's a really terrific lens. And, you know, I know we mentioned, Alex was saying he wanted to get his Hasselblad CL8. Joe Vieira, guys.
It needs to go to Joe.
If you're in the Toronto area or Canada or even in the, I guess, northern US, if you don't have a local Hasselblad person, look up Joe Vieira, Hasselblad Service.
Yeah.
He tore mine down from top to bottom. It is a brand new Hasselblad right now.
Well, that's exactly what I hope to do next year with my 500C, is get it torn down to and just totally rebuild.
My 82A planar from my Hasse kit needs a date with Joe. It needs a lot of help.
Yeah, I had no idea that this is what a Hasselblad is supposed to sound like.
Yep.
It's so quiet compared to when I first got it. It was not that quiet.
Well, moving from the object at the front of the camera into what we put inside the camera, and that is film.
Films.
And when EGFA stopped, well, not manufacturing film, but marketing film themselves, the world took a hit. We lost the APX line and a bunch of other great films. But what people don't realize is EGFA still makes film. They just sell it through different people. And the biggest one of those is the Rollei brand, which we know for their beautiful TLRs, their tiny 35 millimeters, which Bill has recently come to know and love.
Yeah, I borrowed my brother's Rollei 35 with the 43.5 Tessar lens, and I know I've bashed compact cameras in the past, but those are the 1990s and early 2000s plastic fantastics.
Yep,
a late 60s, like this thing is, I think even tinier than the Minox, like that John brought for an upcoming episode. It's like, wow, this is like a little bit of jewelry, but it's like, again, you have to zone focus, but
it's like a little spy camera.
Absolutely. It's a spy camera you can fit into your, well, not your jeans pocket, but definitely a coat pocket. And if you're, you know, on your, say, if you're doing a lot of business travel and you can't lug a, you know, a Hasselblad with a 50 Distagon with you, a Zeiss 35 could probably fill the bill just nicely.
Absolutely. And, well, we have talked about the RPX line of films in the past, which are, as I've said, the spiritual successors to the APX line of film. They have quite a lot of other fantastic offerings. My personal favorite, and one that I've had a lot of trouble finding the right developer film combination for, is Retro ADS. This is not an infrared film, but it is pretty damn close to it, especially when you start putting filters in front of it. I was in Windsor, Ontario for an IT college IT department conference, And I took as many opportunities as I could to actually not go to the conference. And I can say that out loud because goodness knows I saw my college's associate vice president information technology out walking along the river as well. And like I said, this is a fickle film for me. It's taken me a while to find a good developer combination for it. This is ideally an ASA ISO 80 speed film. It has extended red sensitivity almost into the infrared band. You start seeing that once you put a deep yellow filter on it. I really like it with that yellow 15. You start seeing darkening of the sky, lightening of your greens. But you want the best results out of it. You put it through Ilford Microfin. And it's just smooth as everything. Medium format, 35 millimeter. There is no grain whatsoever. HC110 surprised me. Rodinal 1 to 50, contrasty as hell, but not a bad combination. The one thing you do need to watch out for is that it doesn't have as wide a latitude as people like to think it does. And we're talking about one of our absentee hosts who like to push film to their absolute limit. If you do start pulling it, you gotta put a filter in front of it because you will lose your highlights like nobody's business. But that's not the only film that comes from Rolleye. Another one is Superpan 200. And John, you've had a lot of experience with Superpan.
Yep, I've shot it mainly in medium format. I want to throw a couple of points in more about the ADS,
yeah,
if I can. A couple of recipes that I've used. I've tried the Rodinal, and yes, like this is a film, treat it like slide film.
Yes.
If you overexpose the highlights, you are toast.
Yep.
I've developed it in T-Max. One to four for 7 minutes because I had the roll mislabeled. Oops. And it was a happy accident. It turned out quite nice. Also, if you're willing to get your hands dirty and mix up some chemistry, D23, which is an inherently a lower contrast developer, also
helps. Last time I tried Retro ADS with D23, it was through my Hasselblad and the Distagon lens. I shot it in Ottawa and got a blank roll because the shutter was dead.
Ooh,
there's 12 minutes I'll never get back.
I shot one roll of ADS through my Leica M3 on a thoroughly miserable March day around downtown Oakville one morning after my usual workout. Again, as John kind of put it, it's the perfect film for the gray Toronto sort of winter and shoulder season where there are 1,000 different terms for gray skies. I got amazing results out of it with just HC110 dilution B. It was like, wow, okay, I get it.
I shot it at a rainy day in Scotland.
Oh, that'd be perfect.
I promise I will get to the Super Pan, but yeah. One thing more we'll say about the ADS is because it is so extended for the red sensitivity, if you throw a red filter on there, I don't think it takes quite as much increase in the exposure. The filter factor, let's say for a 25A is 8. So you divide 80 by 8, it gives you ISO 10. I would try, ISO 15 or sorry, EI 15, EI 20 even, because it just allows so much light to come in. And it darkens the skies like nobody's business. Now to the Super Pan. The Super Pan is a very nice film. I've only shot it in, that I can recall, in medium format. It is very nice. It's sort of a brother, like along with the Retro 400S, I guess we'll talk about. It's very similar. It has that extended red sensitivity, so it'll work at in the infrared range. You can even use like an IR 76 filter, I think it is, or 72 rather. And again, because for me, medium format, grain's not as big of an issue, but it is not as fine grain as ADS. So, before I know, Alex, you've had
actually
some...
found Superpan to be fairly grainy for even a 200 speed film at medium format.
I agree. I'm actually trying to find some sample images because I remember shooting some on it. It was like a fairly bright day. I think when we were doing a photo walk down by the sewage treatment plant, I was shooting Superpan that day.
Yeah.
And a bit gray, but still bright enough. But yeah, I wasn't too happy with the results
especially
from a grain perspective.
In HC110, I've since Stan developed it in Rodinal, and it loves that.
Interesting. I'll
try that.
Even
that's
at 200 and medium format. And the one thing that surprised me was D76 1:1 in 35mm. Those results blew my mind.
Hmm.
It was kind of like, okay... It's D76. I'm not expecting it to be fine grain, but where's the grain? 35mm. Like, this is a grainy film at medium format. Where did the grain go?
Now, I might be whipping a segue on you here, but I would say that if you want a film that's like ADS, but you want to shoot it at ISO or at EI 200, the one to get is the Retro 400.
400S. Yes, that is another interesting film.
I've shot bucket loads of that film.
And it's a great 200 speed film. It is not a 400 speed film.
No.
Process at HC110, dilution B, you get like 5-6 minutes.
Yep.
You're golden. It's like no muss, no fuss.
I came across Retro 400S completely by accident. It was coming off of
the fingers slipped when you were ordering something else?
No. It was coming off of a Toronto Film Shooters meetup. I had some hours to kill before meeting up with James McFarlane for a concert at the Dakota Tavern. And I had a bit of a walk from where I was. So I'm like, well, you know, I have my Nikon F5. I got my 105 F2D. I'm going to do some street photography. And I wandered into Downtown Camera, and I'm like, Retro 400S, I've never shot that before. Let's give it a try. And I developed it in T-Max Developer, and the results were stunning. Absolutely stunning. Again, you have that extended red sensitivity, you got the speed of 400, and in T-Max Developer, it looks wonderful. And that became my standard developer for Retro 400S. I've since done it in a couple other developers. But I was shooting it in Fergus. And I'd left a deep yellow filter, again, the yellow 15. And all of a sudden, it's like, did I shoot IR film? Was it accidentally re-spooled? Because as soon as you start filtering it, it's like, oh, hello, I'm an IR film. I'm just going to behave like that. Because the skies were black. It's like, yellow 15's never done that for me.
What I found the 400 really good for is again, those dull, you know, sky looks like wet concrete kind of days. I shot a bunch of it a couple of years ago on a... when I was in Vancouver in November for a week.
Mm.
Not a whole lot of sunshine.
New.
And also last year around, you know, not too long from now, sort of like late September, early October last year, I was up in the Muskoka area at Billy Bear, and I was shooting the 400 in the Hasselblad, like early morning, not a whole lot of light out yet. But I was so happy with the pictures I got. So, you know, the 400 and the 80, that's a pretty good 1-2 punch.
Yeah, I wound up using the Retro 400S essentially from roughly about, let's say, now-ish till about April, almost. Like, if I need to use Tri-X, I'll probably push it to 1600 in some occasions. But again, I find some weird fact in where I'm developing. Tri-X dries flat for me between April and roughly October. And between October and April, it cups like crazy. So then I go to Retro 400S or HP5.
Yep. Yeah.
I'm going to throw in one word of caution, particularly about the 80 and 35. Because this is a very, very like thin film.
Yeah, it has a polyester base, thinner than paper.
Yeah, if you're loading your own, light piping is a possibility. Yep. So I would not use the first two or three frames on a roll to shoot that picture of Elvis. with the aliens and the UFO.
Yes.
I generally load, I try and look for, if I was, say, rolling, load even like a factory load of retro 400S or even like Bellamy Hunt's Streepan 400, which is basically from the same factory. And it's the same polyester base. You look for somewhere there's no direct sunlight and your back is to the window anyway, just to be on the safe side.
Absolutely. And the final film from Roll Eye, and probably one of the few true IR films that is left on market, is their IR-400 film. And it is beautiful. You really want to shoot it in medium format because IR film is grainy. It's always grainy, and you just want to put it behind that R72 filter or the 89B filter, just to be on the safe side. But again, loves Rodinal, surprisingly, but you're pulling it to like 25 by that point. You're pulling it to 25, you're pulling it to 12 behind the filter. Loves Rodinal, surprisingly likes HG110 and D76 as well. But if you're getting into the 35mm, you're going to see grain quite a bit. Yeah. So again, film definitely still lives. EGFA's still around. Don't count it out yet. And if you want something a little different from your Fuji, your Kodak, your Ilford, Roll Eye. Solid line of films. The RPX line is well loved among everyone on the table.
RPX 25 is one of my favorite films.
And have you shot it in 4x5 yet?
I have not. I've shot it in 120, and it's amazing.
Do it in 4x5.
Yeah. I have a box sitting there, too.
There you go.
I love RPX 100 and 400.
Yep.
I miss the APX 100, 400, and this is the Descendant.
I just shot my last roll of APX 100 a couple of weeks ago.
RPX 100 in medium format, stand developed for an hour in Rodinal is a pretty fair replacement for a Cross.
Nice.
Yeah. Actually, I was in downtown Camera last week, and I bought two bricks of Across in 135 because they have about 10 bricks there. I should probably go buy that before this episode goes on air, but
oh, it's probably gone by now anyway.
No, this was Friday. They showed me them all.
There you go.
And they're like, do you want them all? I'm like, yeah, I want them all, but I'm not going to leave here $2,000 lighter in my wallet.
But at this point, James, you're going to need a refrigerated shipping container in your driveway for all the Across you're hoarding.
I know. You know what? I have a love-hate relationship with Fuji, but anyway.
Whatever.
What can you do? I just test shot a roll of, I'm halfway through the roll of the new Agfa slide film, Vericolor or something. I forget what it's. I think it's an Agfa slide.
VarioPan?
Yeah, I think so.
That's a Roll Eye product.
You know what? I'll have to check the roll. I could have swore it was an Agfa, a new Agfa slide film.
It's Agfa.
Yeah.
But it's manufactured under Roll Eye.
It's strange. It's like an Agfa box.
All right.
Let's get to the bottom of this. Carry on.
Well, that's about covers it for this episode. James has left the table.
James is on a mission.
But
he's back coming back now.
Hold on.
Okay. Survey says.
Pulls out.
He's looking.
I'm looking through the window on the back of the camera. I'm sure that's Agfa. It's red.
We'll put it in the notes.
Hold on. Oh, so that's Agfa Photo. So, like I said earlier, Agfa manufactures film, but they sell it under different companies. So, a lot of Lomography slide film is Agfa made. The Roll Eye films are Agfa made. And then there was Agfa Photo. And again, it's a holding company.
Just another brand that they sell their film.
That's right. Yeah. So again, they sell the Vista and the CT Precisia.
Yeah, Vista, that's what it is. Yeah.
Precisia line.
Precisia line. That's what it is. Yeah.
For their color
old
film.
Age.
Yeah, it's essentially, I think, Provia slide film.
No, it's Agfa slide film.
Agfa photo.
Yeah.
So it's not a Fuji emulsion. It's their own emulsion.
Yeah.
Interesting, because I thought if they bought sort of cast-offs from Fuji with
I don't know, but like Fuji was still, up until, I don't know, a month ago, was still producing Provia, so.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? Fuji's a black box of an organization. If
I don't know. And then
one.
There's rumors that Akros is not being discontinued anymore, but.
Yeah.
I'll believe that when I see the news release.
Well, I looked at, yeah, you can't find 120 anywhere of Akros, but.
Yep.
And that is my go to. For medium format, 100 ISO film, it's like.
And B&H and Freestyle, and who cares about Adorama? They don't have any Akros in stock on their websites anymore. But Downtown Camera has about 500 rolls.
And by just saying that, James, you're just instructing the hordes to go clean it out.
Well,
whatever.
But James is going to beat them to it anyway.
I don't know. I've stockpiled a whole pile of 120.
There you go.
And now I have about 30 rolls of 135, but I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to miss that damn film.
Well, that's about it for this episode. My name's Alex Lokes, and I'm saying, like our first episode on lenses, date your cameras, marry your lenses.
This is Bill Smith. I wish I had something witty to say. Just, shoot tons of film. You know what to do. Press the shutter, process, scan. We see. That's all.
This is John Meadows. Sometimes overcoming technical issues in podcasting is like S&M. You need electrical tape and the proper voltage.
And on that note, I got nothing. I'm not even... Yeah. Yeah.
Say your name.
This is James Lee, and I'm cold and scared.
I had a lots for words.